I'd like to welcome to the program Joan Tewksbury. She is a writer and filmmaker, and she's the author of the new novel, Ebba and the Green Dresses of Olivia Gomez in a Time of Conflict and War. She will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So, Joan, after many years of filmmaking, stage, TV, screenwriting, all of this stuff, you've decided to write a novel. Why?
It is such a great relief to be able to sit down in a room and not have anyone dictate to you, a car crash has to happen here, three things have to happen by the... You know, none of that. You sit down and you simply can explore these characters or these ideas, and it's like taking a vacation. It's been an amazing sort of experience.
Are there not formal constraints? And okay, it's not like the Hollywood thing where you have to have a car crash or whatever, but and the love interest has to appear by page three.
Right.
But there are still surely formal necessities that the novel brings with it.
Yes, there are a beginning, a middle, and an end of sorts. But for me, because I don't know enough, it's all of it tends to be a kind of math problem. It's almost like the book has been written like music. There are certain passages of music that connect to one another. And so the sum of the parts make the whole. And oddly, I never thought so much about how it was going to, the emotional builds, or I just wrote. And I wrote sections, and after a lot of these sections were written, I put them together.
So you didn't write chronologically?
Sometimes not at all.
Very interesting.
No. And then the other thing, I guess it comes from the years in the editing room. After I had the material, then I could construct it in a way where there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I always write with too many characters. I always write with too many situations. But from the discipline of the film industry, being able to lace them together in a way, sometimes with images, it's almost like reading a movie as you read the book.
Well, I was thinking about that because I've read sometimes screenplays, and one of the things about the screenplay is that if you're reading it and you haven't seen the movie, you have to fill in a great deal in your head, but that's the way it's supposed to be because the director and the actors and the visual reality of the film fill in all the stuff that's not in the screenplay.
My problem was that I always filled it in, and everyone said, oh, can you take it out? The page count is too long. We don't need this information. But in a funny way, everybody needs the information. They may not agree with it, but it is a departure point that they can either spring from, explode, make bigger, diminish, or change, but at least they know what was in your head before you started. So the great thing about the novel is no one tells you to take that part out.
Right, unless you are working with an editor.
Exactly, who says take that out. Yes.
Right. Now, this novel has the feel of a kind of Latin American novel, maybe by Gabriel Garcia Marquez or somebody like that, and it takes place in an unnamed Latin American country. Why did you choose that setting and in some ways that style?
I think it was because it, in a funny way, it's a microcosm for any small place. It's a small village. Things take place. It's like here. It's a small town. So everybody runs into everybody else. But there was such, when I started this book, I was so stunned by the kinds of things that were happening with people being disappeared, and especially with the children, and the kidnapping of the children, and being given to childless couples, that I was intrigued by being able to write big, in other words, write big ideas, that they weren't that theatrical, that they, because they were actually happening in the world. So it allowed me to give voice to big things, and also to let the humor come out of the situations, because some of those situations are so ridiculous. And always at the core of it that there is a love story.
Right. Give us an example of one of the ridiculous situations.
I'm trying to think of, well, just the idea that a 12-year-old girl or a 13-year-old girl and a 30-year-old young man can come together in a kind of equal sparring way, that's where they both take up equal space, one doesn't give in to the other, and that they are equals in this situation. But they're both damaged goods, but they come together very powerfully. All the mothers in the piece have strong voices, and you'd like to give a lot of them a ringing slap. But it allowed me to write about the situations that so many of us have experienced, that when you look back, you say to yourself, oh my God, you know, did that really happen? And yes, it did, and you lived through it. So I would say that the situations in the book often are about survival, and that each of these people in their own way is surviving one kind of situation or another. And sometimes it gets funny. When you think that this woman who's madly in love with a plumber brings down the whole village over the fact that she wants these green dresses, it's ridiculous. You know?
Right. And yet the nature of passion is perhaps the most rational thing in human experience.
Exactly. And so it is about this misplaced passion everywhere.
We're talking to Joan Tewksbury about her new novel. Now, do you see this as a film? Like when you were writing it and then now that it's done?
No, it's as far as I'm concerned, this is the movie between the covers. Because when I write visually, so the images are there. And I usually write from specific images. I used a lot of photographs in this. A lot of the research that I did was not just the diary research or historical research, but they were photographs. And so in that way, I've made the movie in a funny way already.
Tell us more about the research that you did.
For the first go-round of the novel, I did none. I simply wrote from imagination. And then I was given the opportunity to read diaries of survivals, of the people who had survived.
In Argentina?
In various places throughout Guatemala. I'm trying to remember the specifics. But the accounts were poignant and strong, and everyone that had survived was not diminished. They were definitely changed, but they were not diminished in a way that you would think, oh, they've been beaten down or they will never be the same again.
Although they probably never will be the same again.
They will never be the same again, but yet there was a strength or a power to them that they had come through this with a kind of wisdom or a kind of overview of the situation, at least for themselves. It wasn't great. And there were several authors and journalists who whose voices were immediate and strong. And so I felt when I started this, I thought, how dare you? How dare you be so arrogant as to think that you can write about this kind of subject matter when you haven't experienced it? But there is something in the humanity of all of us that allows us to experience it through other means. And so I can't answer your question directly, because when I take in information, I'm like a vacuum cleaner, and I suck in small pieces of everything I can find. And so I finally was confident enough, after having read the accounts, read the histories and followed some of these journalists, or the journalism and the poetry. And the poetry of Nicanor Parra was very acute to the situation because he writes with a very dark, ironic, humorous tone. I thought, okay, he's from the place, he was in prison, he went through it. Okay, I can do that. I can use that tone. And it may offend someone, you know, some people, and I'm sure it will. But that's the power of what I can do.
When you were talking, I was wondering whether the people who survived these most horrifying human situations in terms of what one person or group of people can do to another, it's the worst there is. It's the worst that humanity gets. It's worse than probably anything in the animal kingdom. I mean, it's the nadir of life. And the people who survive this and are strengthened by it, I wonder if the ones who have the strength to write about it are the ones who have that, what would you call it, survivor's...
Wisdom.
Wisdom, strength, and unwillingness to completely give in.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's, in that stance, or in that kind of experience, when your body, when it's been taken into your body, and you've had to receive it in a way, it is you, it becomes you, and so you are confident in speaking about it, or talking about it, or you go in the other direction and you never speak about it again.
Which is true of a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a few years ago at Site Santa Fe.
Yes.
An exhibition called The Disappeared.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
It was called The Disappeared. It was one of the strongest exhibitions I've ever seen in Santa Fe. And one of the most powerful exhibits within that very powerful show was of this story, which is one of the stories that you're telling, of people who were tortured, their children, pregnant women, their children were taken away from them as soon as they gave birth. Then the mothers were killed, and these children were given to childless, usually military couples. And a very good Argentine movie was made about that in the early 80s. And in this exhibit, they had found the pictures of the young couple, the mother and father, and they put mirrors between them so that people who were adopted, who thought they might, and there were a few people who actually found who their real parents were.
And the thing is that the grandmothers never forgot.
Right.
And the newspaper accounts, I was sent newspaper accounts from papers in London, where the grown children, the grandmothers, would track down their descendants,
right,
find these kids, and the children would then have to deal with the fact that they had been raised by the torturers of their own parents,
right,
or the murderers, in many cases, of their own parents. And to me, that is the most... I cannot imagine the kind of split that occurs in a child who has to come to terms with that kind of situation.
And especially because the split in the parents who raised them was equally strong, namely that they were probably capable of being loving parents.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of these people were given opportunities they never would have had, educated, etc. But there was a wonderful picture in, and I can't remember which newspaper it was, but these kids were throwing garbage at the military who were finally going to be tried for these war crimes. And there was something in the grandmothers' faces who were behind these children that it was wonderful, because at last these older women had been vindicated.
Now, you have been teaching writing, screenwriting, I think, mostly stage writing also, and you have a title which is Designed Obstacles.
Yes, and so the class, I really don't teach any kind of format writing, basically what I'm trying to do in the class is just to get you, I give you a series of problems and ask you to write your way out of them. And then I give you more problems. But at the end of each 10-minute period or 15-minute period, I ask you to read your work out loud. Because part of the process is owning your own voice. A lot of writers never speak their own words. So in the course of this class, what's happened is the strengthening of some of these voices that is fabulous. And I would say that the most exciting stuff that I have done in the last 2 years is teach this class. It, too, is ridiculous because of the kinds of assignments that I give. But it is to totally pull you out of what you already know and make you do not know what you're going to do. And then suddenly say you have 10 minutes and you would be amazed at the stories that have come out of this.
It sounds sort of like the what some people do when they teach improv.
It's very much along the... And as a matter of fact, a lot of the fellows in the class are actors. Some of them are directors. Some of them are artists. There are a couple of people who do music. There are just some folks who come, you know, have come in because they had been writing. And the idea is also that they all hear each other. And in hearing each other's stories, they get braver and more brave and then really brave. And there is the hope that we will be able to put these into be all these stories between covers and do a book of this year or two writing from the Milagro program.
So it got to the level of what you might call finished work as opposed to exercises.
It's in a funny way, each one of these exercises became finished work. They're like flash stories. You know, they are read, you probably would read these aloud in the course of 2 or 3 minutes. But in the course of that, you have gotten a section of life that you have never thought you would ever hear or even think about.
Now, were the students pulling this stuff out of thin air, or were they coming from their own experiences?
I think it's mostly coming from your own experience. And with that kind of framework, You don't have time to dream. You simply have to pull it up. And when the class started, I always tell people at the beginning of it, and I've taught this class all over the world, but I tell students or fellows that if they're there to learn how to write a screenplay or get an agent or any of those things, they're in the wrong class. It's just, that's not what this is. It is really to ignite the imagination so that it can retrieve what it's forgotten it knows. And so it's fun, but most of all, it is such a privilege to sit and hear these stories, you know, every month. We now meet, because we haven't been able to meet at Las Luceras, we're meeting at various... places, you know, on a probably once a month basis. But
is it always new people, or do you have an ongoing group?
No, it's an ongoing group, and then we filter in new people. Some of the other fellows have gone off to work, so it allows room for some other people to come in. When this was announced about a year and a half ago, I can't remember, we had maybe 50 applicants. And I was asked by the film commission, how are you going to narrow it down? And I said, I'm not. So they all came. And
they filtered themselves out.
And then they filtered themselves out. They get busy. This is not what they're looking for. And, you know, fine, whatever. But those that have stayed, it's been fascinating to see the capacity and the journey. And the students are from 19 years old to 60, you know. So there's also, they get to hear these various parts of life, you know, one to the other. And that's very, that's a privilege too. You know.
Now, do you use any of the processes that you teach in your own process?
I probably do, but I'm I'm not aware of it. If you know, if I'm stuck, I will usually walk away from the desk or go do other things that are outside, just to clear your head and all of that. And I don't go to the movies.
You don't go to the movies?
No, I don't go to the movies because it's too much stimulation. And so it's almost as though leaving the movie that I'm working on in my computer.
Right.
I need to be in a place where there's nothing but nature, or, you know, whether it's snowing or so hot you think you're going to die or whatever. But just to get out and see what happens. Often taking a shower is good, too, you know.
Yeah, some of one's best ideas, I think some of one's best ideas come where water is concerned.
Uh-huh.
Either taking a shower, doing the dishes.
Yes.
Or walking by a river.
Yes, very good. Yes, water's a very good ingredient to all of this. Yeah.
We're talking to Joan Tewksbury. Her new novel is called Ebba and the Green Dresses of Olivia Gomez in a Time of Conflict and War. And she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, and the wonderful Jonathan Richards will be there with you.
Bless his heart, yes. Yes.
Are you planning on continuing with fiction writing, or what are your next projects?
Yes, the next is fiction. I can't get out of the village. It is an extension of this story. It's what happens after Olivia Gomez becomes mayor. And I'm also working on another play. But the lore of the village is quite complete as far as I'm concerned. I keep getting drawn back in.
It's so interesting when a novel is finished, or indeed when, for example, a TV series is over and it's been canceled and you don't get to see season 2 and you're dying to know what happens. It's such a funny thing because you really think, what happened to such and such a person? And they're not real.
No, they're not, but they're so real that it's just shocking. You know, it's true. The beauty of television at this time is that it's almost like watching novels over a whole 22 episodes,
right.
You know. And
yeah, an episode is a chapter.
It's fabulous. And to me, television right now is probably at one of the highest points.
What are some of your favorite television shows?
Breaking Bad. Mm. And all the masterpiece, of course, the masterpiece theater, the mysteries, those kinds of things. And then Law and Order. I'm sorry, I'm a great fan of Law and Order.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a great way to visit the courtroom. I worked on a television show for about 3 years called The Guardian. And it was a real privilege to be able to do an extended story with fabulous writers. And I would say that some of the best writers working now are working in television.
I have to say, Freaks and Geeks was one of the best shows, in my view, one of the best shows ever made. And when it was canceled, that was a crime against humanity and art and truth.
Yes, I think my son felt the same way.
Yeah, it's a generational thing.
Yes,
sort of
think.
But
yes.
It's interesting because, I mean, a novel really can't be made into a movie without losing most of the novel. You can get sort of the basic plot points, but all the subplots which have to be there in a novel. And I realized once when there was in the 80s, somebody made some Latin American short stories into films.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it turns out that a sort of medium-length short story you can fully make into a feature-length film.
Right. When you... A film is like a comic book version. I don't mean this disparagingly, but it is like a comic book version of something, because you are literally dealing with images and squares, you know, and stringing those things together. So some of the more complicated things that happen, there are a few filmmakers that enjoy the kind of layering that you can do within a frame, but the larger budget films tend to go toward the more simplified, the very clear black and white hatted characters.
Right.
So there's, you don't have to figure out the complexity. You can just take the journey, you know, of this quick ride. And it was interesting in watching Batman, the character that Heath Ledger brought to that character of the Joker was almost more than people could bear, because it was so complicated.
Yeah.
But for me, it was spectacular in the way that real fairy tales can become spectacular, because they weave you in and out of the light and the dark so that you get, it's not just either or. I mean, you have to go the dark road to get to the light road.
Right.
And sometimes that doesn't happen in, you know, some
in,
of the films.
In Hollywood movies?
In
really? Lack of moral ambiguity?
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I've been, I'm going to admit my dark secret, ladies and gentlemen. I've been watching the entirety of the TV show The Closer. I've been renting it on DVD. And almost all of, and The Closer is a character named Brenda Lee Johnson, who's deputy chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, and she always gets people to confess. That's sort of the formula of the program. And she gets a confession most episodes, though not all. But the fascinating thing is there's almost always moral ambiguity about whether that person is really wrong in what they did or how that whole situation came together. Occasionally there's a true deep villain, but a lot of the time there's not. And I love that.
Yes. And the thing that was great about The Guardian was that this young man, played by Simon Baker, had been arrested for drugs. He was an attorney, a very high-powered attorney in a very fancy law firm. But he had to do social work with kids and be an attorney for children in trouble. So in every episode, there was this double-sided, not only the socioeconomics, but with his being pulled back and forth, sometimes into the drug world, sometimes. So it was never resolved. Was this a good guy? Was he, you know. So that's my kind of deal, you know.
Joan Tewksbury is a writer and filmmaker. Her new novel is called Ebba and the Green Dresses of Olivia Gomez in a Time of Conflict and War. And once again, she'll be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Hank Hughes. He's the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, and Reverend Ray Masterson of Santa Fe Street Ministries and Revel Carr. He's a maritime historian and veteran. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Now, we are talking today, it's a couple of days after Veterans Day, about the specific problems of homelessness that are faced by veterans and why so many veterans are homeless. What's going on?
Well, I've worked in homelessness for many years, and there's always been a large number of homeless people who are veterans, and it relates in part to what happens to people when they're in the service, in wars, post-traumatic stress disorder, that sort of thing, and when they come home, we just don't have enough supports for them, and so some people end up on the streets sleeping outside, and that's a real tragedy.
There were so many Vietnam veterans. How does that compare to veterans of other wars?
I think what we're seeing today is a huge increase in veterans who have been stressed, and the post-traumatic stress disorder is the key element here, who have been stressed by multiple tours in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And so layered on top of the trauma of Vietnam. The trauma of Vietnam was a national trauma, and it was a trauma for so many of the soldiers, Marines, sailors, and so on who participated there. But so it's compounded. We have the burden of still dealing with the Vietnam heritage, and on top of that, now it's being compounded by Iraq and Afghanistan multiple tour veterans.
The people who were in Vietnam, were you, Ray, were you one of them?
No comment.
All right. I guess what I'm trying to ask is that people were there, usually young men in their teens and early 20s, and now those folks are pretty much in their 60s. What have these intervening 40 years been like for them? What's the typical kind of patterns that you see?
Well, for a lot of them, they've been homeless for a long time, a lot of that time. But a lot of people like Ray, who is a Vietnam-era veteran, at least that's what he tells me, eventually they get help and they get out and become contributing members of our society. And what we're trying to do is speed up that process so people don't end up spending 15 years living outside while nothing happens in their life and they just get older and weaker.
Are you focusing on the current Iraq and Afghanistan veterans right now?
Well, I think every veteran, and the services we have now, there's not enough for everybody, so it really goes to people who come in for help. And so it tends to be that as people get older, they tend to come in more for help. And so we're still dealing a lot with people who are in the Vietnam era, but actually plenty of people from all the wars of the last 30 years.
I think the other point is one out of five homeless individuals in this country are vets. And so that's a much higher proportion. The vets make up a much higher proportion than the general population, so to speak. But I think that's part of the issue. And the other thing is, in addition to homes, housing, there's an issue of support for services. There are a lot of services out there. The VA has services available. Other agencies have services available. But navigating through the bureaucracies of those services is really daunting. We all know it's daunting to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's daunting to go to
although less so than it used to be.
Well, perhaps. But it's daunting to go to healthcare services for any of us. And when a homeless individual who may not have all the paperwork he or she needs, and there are more women now between the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, there are more women who are ending up as homeless vets as well. But those people seek services, it's really hard to navigate the complexities of the system, and that's another thing that our effort here to raise funds can support. And we can support agencies that help give that guidance.
So it's not that you're offering the services yourself necessarily, you're offering the assistance to navigate those crazy bureaucracies.
Well, it's a combination, because clearly the federal government has the main responsibility for taking care of our veterans. And so part of what we want to do is make sure they step up to the plate. Some people, as Revel said, they have trouble navigating that system. And so we want to fund agencies that will, work with the help the federal government's providing and help people get into that and provide whatever extra help they need.
Ray Masterson, Reverend Ray Masterson, tell us about the Santa Fe Street Ministries.
I minister on the street. I do a lot of outreach. I talk to a lot of homeless people besides working the shelter during the winter. A lot of times, a lot of the programs, you got to understand that back in the early 1990s, I was Veterans Affairs Coordinator for the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. During the first Persian Gulf War, which ended in February, I had the first homeless vet in my office seeking help by April. Mm-hmm. From the first Persian Gulf War. So, everybody always relates back to Vietnam and the Vietnam era for, the originality of homeless veterans. No, as long as there have been war, there have been homeless veterans. Part of homelessness and veterans is one of the true costs of war that was ignored for many, many, many years. Korea, right on back to the revolution, we have had veterans who became homeless for whatever reason. So, you know, it's really nothing new. It was really over the past 10 years or so that I've seen is a lot of other veterans organizations starting to really look at this problem as linked, you know, because VFW and many other organizations, they do fight for veterans' rights. But homelessness among veterans has always taken kind of a back seat.
Right.
You know, now I see some of them starting to step up and say, hey, wait a minute, those are my brothers and my sisters out there, you know, who are actually continually suffering from whichever war they were in. So some of them have never even come home.
Your own story, I mean, you yourself were homeless for a stretch?
For a long time.
Yeah. How did you handle that? What was it like for you?
Well, first and foremost, I was a Marine. So, you know, it was just part of it. I've learned to deal and cope with certain things that helped me. But the main thing was a few people that started believing in me again. You know, instead of just, oh, well, that's Ray. He's lazy, crazy, lives in a box.
Where were you living?
I was actually homeless here in Santa Fe for over 3 years up on the hill.
Is that right?
In a tent, yeah.
And then what happened next?
I just started networking with people and this and that, and I got my disability straightened out, and, you know, and I got a subsidized apartment and moved from there.
So when you work with people in the, basically in the street, what are your interactions like? How can you help them? What do you see?
Actually, a lot of times it's just listening. Because a lot of times a homeless person isn't listened to. You know, a lot of times I'll sign you up for the program as long as you meet certain criteria. I know homeless veterans on the street that don't fit into them criteria because they're not drug addicts, they're not alcoholics, and they're not crazy. Right? And most of the programs are funded around the counseling. Right? So if you're not a drug addict, if you're not an alcoholic, and you ain't crazy, you don't need counseling, do you? So therefore, if all I'm giving you is housing and a place to live and trying to help you find a job, I'm on the very low end of the funding spectrum. Right? But then I add counseling. Now, whether the counselor is qualified to do it or not is one thing, you know? I mean, I've known homeless veterans that have gone in for counseling sessions, and they're sitting there talking with the person. All of a sudden, the homeless vet goes, excuse me, have you ever been an alcoholic? No. Have you ever been a drug addict? Well, no. Have you ever been homeless? Well, no. This conversation's over.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think a lot of us recognize that, and I'm of course, one of those people who was never any of those things, but we're trying to really push the housing first idea of helping people who are homeless. As Ray was saying, a lot of homeless people object to the kind of programs that insist that they take a certain type of counseling or a certain type of service along with the housing. And so we've really been pushing the idea that housing is a human right and people should get the housing as a first step and then decide on their own what kind of counseling or services they want to participate in, have a choice in the kind of counselor they have, that sort of thing. If it's even necessary. Some people just need housing.
One of the ironies that has developed in this, there was an article in the Times, the New York Times, a few weeks ago, of a young Afghanistan vet who had ended up losing his job, or not getting a job, and not having a home to go to, being homeless. And the irony was that he pointed out his military service didn't prepare him for civilian life. It prepared him for homelessness. It prepared him to live rough. He had lived rough in Afghanistan. And so it was, in a sense, an easy fallback for him. But it's a terrible path because people have to cope with all that you have to cope with when you're living rough. The health, winter, all those issues.
And, of course, the economy right now is pretty bad. I mean, it's bad for a lot of people. It's bad for particularly a lot of young people. There aren't the well-paid entry-level jobs in almost any field anymore.
I think one of the encouraging things in the last few days was Congress finally coming together to pass something, and one of the things they passed was a veterans' jobs bill. That was part of President Obama's jobs package, but the one part that has gotten through with bipartisan support has been the veterans' job bill, and hopefully, I mean, it's a long way to see the benefits of that, but hopefully that will help in this issue.
We've really seen a spike in the number of young families who are homeless based on the economy. The people who are disabled have, you know, were homeless and have stayed homeless, but the economy has really hurt people entering the job market or trying to enter the job market.
Now, there's a group called Veterans Helping Homeless Veterans.
That's the group that we are working with. Tom Augustin, who is a person in this community who does more good work than most of us and is always looking for ways to help. Tom was the inspiration for this. He was an advisor in Hank's organization, and Tom and Hank came up with the thought that focusing on this veterans issue would be of long-term benefit. And so a group of us have come together to work with Tom and with Hank to make that happen, to raise money in the community that can then be distributed to organizations that we are positive are making a real impact on homeless veterans.
What are in your view, the strongest organizations?
Well, some of the organizations that we're looking at, there's a Veterans Integration Center in Albuquerque that has been struggling for many years. They provide a transitional housing opportunities specifically for veterans. But we're also looking at some of the agencies that provide permanent supportive housing to anybody with disabilities, but who are willing to focus part of their program on veterans. So that would be like LifeLink here in Santa Fe that does a really great job with that. St. Elizabeth Shelter has a little bit of their program that is directed toward permanent supportive housing. And so we want to encourage them to develop those parts of it and to concentrate on veterans.
Seems like if you wanted to really end homelessness, one big, huge step would be to stop fighting wars.
Well, that would certainly help.
That's a great solution, and we wish that might happen. But whether that happens in our lifetime, I rather doubt it. It's been going on forever and ever and ever. And as Ray was saying, this issue has been with us forever and ever and ever. And in World War I, it was called shell shock. They didn't understand post-traumatic stress syndrome. And one of the encouraging things now is that increasingly post-traumatic stress disorder is being recognized and people are getting counseling for it. But it's been around from all the wars, as Ray has said, and unfortunately, it'll probably be around in future wars.
How much can counseling really help? I mean, post-traumatic stress, the people I know who have it, I'm not thinking of veterans. I'm thinking of, for example, women who've been raped and things like that. I know people who, no matter how much counseling they get, all their lives, that kind of skittish jumping when somebody comes into the room and a whole set of fears and a whole set of responses, counseling has barely touched it.
Well, I think that's true for veterans as well, and Ray could obviously speak to this much more directly, but I've known many veterans who, you know, it's something that you're going to live with for a long time, but that doesn't mean that you have to be homeless or that you can't be part of society. I mean, all of us have things that we live with on a daily basis. You know, I mean, I'm allergic to juniper trees, and that's not something that I'm ever going to get over either. And it's not that I would compare that to being anything nearly as bad as having PTSD, but I think that it's, we have to realize that people are who they are, and we need to take them from where they are and help them live as full of a life as they can.
An individual that I was associated with, he was a central character in a book that I wrote, and he had post-traumatic stress syndrome from World War II, and it wasn't recognized, it was under-recognized, and he led a tortured life and ultimately committed suicide. And that's the problem when you don't address it. Whether therapy or counseling of some kind can solve the problem is doubtful. Whether it can help people cope with their problem and live a balanced and productive life is something else. And in the case of the person I'm talking about in the book, he was not given those tools.
You know, what's your perspective on that?
Well, they say that Audie Murphy killed himself drunk driving. I believe it was PTSD that killed Audie Murphy. But we'll go to that. But necessarily, war does not cause post-traumatic stress disorder. Anything can cause it. A spanking from childhood, it depends. You learn to deal. You learn to cope. You learn to what pushes your buttons, what pulls your triggers. You learn to deal with that. There is no cure for PTSD.
Right.
You know, one of the best things is talking with somebody else with the same experiences and sharing your coping mechanisms with each other. You know, I can learn something from them. Maybe they can learn something from me. And in the course of it, we can help each other.
I take it you've had that experience.
I've been living with it for years.
Yeah, but I mean the experience of helping each other and sharing your coping mechanisms?
More than any paid professional.
Interesting. Now, are there veterans groups that get together in that way here in Santa Fe and talk about stuff?
Well, I know there's a Vietnam veterans group that gets together periodically, I think once a month, for lunch. And that could be viewed as a group therapy session, in a sense. People have come together, and of course, even groups like Veterans of Foreign Wars and so on are part of that, where people come and they are able to talk about their experiences. But what you see very often is people who are really dealing with it don't like to talk about. They really need, as Ray is alluding to, a sense of confidence in the person to whom they are speaking. They generally don't want to talk about their experiences.
So how can people get involved? People are listening to this. They might be interested in doing their share, contributing to the campaign or contributing their time.
Well, we have a website for the Coalition to End Homelessness, and that's a way to get in touch with us. We're accepting donations to this campaign, so people can either send us a check or go on our website and donate online. We asked if you want your donation to go to the Veterans campaign, that you note that on the check or in the little box online that allows you to do that.
What is the website?
The website is www.nmceh.org. Or you can just Google the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness.
And is there a phone number people can call?
Uh-huh, 982-9000 in Santa Fe.
Area code 505. Anything else that you want to let our listeners know before we go?
Well, I think the staggering number of veterans who are make up that portion of the homeless population is a bit of awareness. There are over 130,000 homeless veterans around the country on any given night, and there are something like 5,000 homeless veterans here in New Mexico and somewhere between 350 and 400 here in Santa Fe. So it is a huge issue, and I think we owe these people who have served their country well, I think we owe these people the best support we can provide.
Hank Hughes is Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. Reverend Ray Masterson is with Santa Fe Street Ministries, and Revel Carr is a maritime historian and himself a veteran. And if you still have last Friday's paper, you can check out. There was in the New Mexican, right?
On the front page in the New Mexican.
Right. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marina Charlotte.
Okay. Thank you.